Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Airstrikes by a Saudi-led coalition in the Yemeni capital Sunday killed at least 22 people, including civilians. It comes a week before the scheduled start of peace talks between rival political factions. The bombings targeted the headquarters of Yemen's armed forces in Houthi rebel-held Sana'a. Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign against the Houthi militia in late March. The United Nations announced Saturday that multilateral negotiations would begin in Geneva on June 14th. The polls have closed in Sunday's crucial parliamentary elections in Turkey, with voters deciding whether to elect lawmakers favoring a rewrite of Ankara's constitution to give President Recep Tayyip Erdogan more power. The initial results are not expected for several hours, but pre-election surveys forecast the most closely contested balloting in more than a decade. VOA's Turkish service reporter Alparslan Esmer reports on the vote.
In general, the voting went relatively smooth and with little violence and vote rigging incidents. And as you can imagine, the ruling conservative AK party is expecting to collect a majority of the votes. But this time the question is how big that majority will be.
More than 53 million voters were eligible to cast ballots. Iraqi forces advanced in the oil refinery town of Baiji on Sunday in a bid to reclaim the area from Islamic State forces for the second time. Military officials said government troops gained ground in this northern city center overnight. IS fighters have targeted oil production sites in Iraq and Syria. U.S. President Barack Obama is scheduled to meet with the Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi on the sidelines of the G summit in Germany. VOA News. The leaders of the world's seven leading industrialized nations met Sunday in the Bavarian Alps, with continued fighting in Ukraine and the Greek debt crisis weighing heavily on the annual summit. For the second year, the leaders met without Russian President Vladimir Putin, turning the G8 into the G7, excluding Russia after its annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. A British official says as many as 500,000 people in Libya are looking to cross the Mediterranean's perilous water this summer to Europe in search of a better life. Captain Nick Cook-Priest said aboard the British warship HMS Bullock that there are indications as many as 500,000 migrants in Libya are waiting at the border for the voyage to cross the Mediterranean. Intense fighting is raging in northeastern Afghanistan, where officials say a government counteroffensive is underway. Ayaz Ghul has details.
On Sunday, Afghan defense officials said ground and air forces are engaged in a counter-operation to retake the mountainous Yamgan district in Badakhshan province. A spokesman for the Afghan defense ministry, Daulat Waziri, tells VOA that national troops are close to ousting the Taliban from Yamgan. He says forces have been dispatched to the area and have inflicted heavy casualties on Taliban fighters, who he says will soon be eliminated from Yamgan. Taliban spokesman Zabiullah Mujahid says its fighters killed at least 18 members of the Afghan security forces before seizing control of the district on Saturday, though the insurgent group's claims are often inflated. The Taliban intensifies its attacks in Afghanistan each summer, but its so-called summer offensive has been more aggressive this year and has spilled over into previously peaceful areas. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Saudi Arabia's top court upheld a 10-year prison sentence and 1,000 lashes for a blogger convicted of insulting Islam, according to his wife Sunday, despite appeals from human rights organizations and the United Nations. Raif Badawi received the first 50 lashes early this year. The 31-year-old father of three was arrested in 2012, accused by Saudi authorities of apostasy and undermining security in the country through the online forum he started to encourage public debate. European financial giant Deutsche Bank announced Sunday that its co-chief executives are stepping down as a banking group faces a wave of scandals and has failed to meet profit targets this year. Anshu Jan will resign at the end of June, while Jürgen Fitschkin plans to stay on the job until after Deutsche Bank's annual shareholder meeting in May of 2016. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
So the Obama administration has made preventing mass killing a priority of the administration. So they created a special board within the government.
The U.S. government is urged to monitor the situation in Zimbabwe following recent violence.
How do we make sure that economic growth, which is so powerful in so much of the continent, benefits all of Africans, lifts up livelihoods and improves lives?
The annual World Economic Forum on Africa ends in Cape Town, South Africa.
We know that potentially all the coffee from South Kivu to North Kivu is great coffee. It's just a question of knowledge, of equipment, of follow-through.
And is there a revival of specialty coffee exports from the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC? We'll have details, those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. President Barack Obama's government is being urged to monitor the situation in the Zimbabwean capital Harare as there are fears the nation might degenerate into chaos. Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service has more.
In an article titled Ominous Warning Signs Resurface in Zimbabwe, which appeared in a foreign policy magazine co-authored by Jeff Smith of Robert F. Kennedy Center for Human Rights and Todd Moss of the Center for Global Development, the two argue that, quote, the Obama administration will need to keep a keen and close eye on the ongoing events in Zimbabwe, including tasking the intelligence services for an assessment of the potential for mass violence. They add that this should include elevating the issue of Zimbabwe to the President's Atrocities Prevention Board, which can readily address the early warning indicators of mass atrocities.
So the Obama administration has made preventing mass killing a priority of the administration. So they created a special board within the government to try to identify potential mass killings and try to take steps to prevent them before they happen.
The two argue that, quote, over the course of the past few months, we have witnessed an ominous series of warning signs, bitter political infighting within the country's ruling party, the worsening of already deplorable economic conditions, the abduction and disappearance of a prominent human rights activist, and a surge of inflammatory rhetoric and political violence. Smith further says there are no signs the situation will improve.
Zimbabwe's history is replete with examples of these sorts of abductions and human rights abuses. And we've certainly seen it recently all through April and in May in Urunguay West, for instance, with the upcoming by-elections. And many of these assaults are happening in full view of the police who have not intervened. So I think taken together, all these instances should be cause for concern.
Moss concurs, adding that though there are many crises unfolding in many parts of the world, Harare must remain a top priority.
There's no reason that the U.S. government can't pay attention to Syria and Burundi and other countries and also keep an eye on potential problems in a place like Zimbabwe.
In a recent exclusive interview with Studio 7, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, Dr. Shannon Smith, said Washington is keeping Zimbabwe on its radar.
Zimbabwe is not falling off the radar. It does matter. It matters to people in Southern Africa. It matters to people here.
But on the question of possible intervention in Harare and a possibility of chaos, Smith said Zimbabweans must control their destiny.
The future of Zimbabwe is in its own hands, clearly. Every country has processes in place to deal with those kind of questions. That our emphasis is on the importance of adhering to the rule of law in such processes.
Opposition political parties that have been warring recently are uniting to warn of a deteriorating situation in Harare. Opposition Movement for Democratic Change leader Morgan Tsvangirai says Zimbabwe is on the verge of disaster.
I can tell you that in their preoccupation with intra-political fights, no one is paying attention to the erosion of the economic well-being of the people. And eventually, people cannot just watch. And that's the most dangerous thing. it will cause instability in the country.
At the same time, the MDC Renewal Team Secretary General Tendai Biti says the ruling ZANU-PF has no clue in addressing the national issues, making the situation even more explosive.
Clearly, we are ripe for an implosion. And naturally, the African Union and all responsible authorities must watch Zimbabwe very closely, because all the ingredients that were in Rwanda in 1994 are in Zimbabwe at the present moment. Hate speech and hatred, toxicity. 2, absence of opportunities. 3, a huge army of unemployed people in social crisis. 4, a leadership vacuum. Our president is now an occasional visitor to Zimbabwe. Cabinet had limits. All these things create a shaky background. So my colleague Todd and Jeff are definitely spot on.
Legal expert David Coulthard of the MDC formation led by Washman Ngube echoes Biti's sentiments.
Part of the problem is that there's a terrible political vacuum in the country. If you have a combination of a political vacuum and a country which is rudderless, with people controlling weapons in a country who have a history of violence, then you have a recipe for a very serious situation in any country.
Smith and Moss also argue that, quote, just as important, authorities in the capital, Harare, must know that the world is watching. But ZANU-PF Politburo member Munyaradzi Paul Mangwana says Zimbabwe is a sovereign state and is stable, and there is no need for foreign intervention.
That has always been their wish, that if they put us under sanctions, then the economy will melt down, and then the people rise up against their government. Unfortunately, that will remain wishful thinking. The people of Zimbabwe support their government. They know that the Americans are the enemies of Zimbabwe. And the Zimbabwean government is in total control of this country.
Political temperatures have been on the rise in Harare, owing to unemployment, which is estimated to be nearing 90%, though the government officially puts it at 10%. The recent threats that government will forcibly evict an estimated 5.5 million vendors from the streets by Monday has also stoked tensions in the country. This is Blessing Zulu.
The annual World Economic Forum on Africa has ended in Cape Town, South Africa. This year's forum focused on finding ways to ensure the continent's economic growth helps not only investors and business owners, but ordinary Africans as well. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
For centuries, the African continent has been seen as an economic battlefield for its rich natural resources. But officials, investors, and business leaders have tried for 25 years to change that mindset at the annual World Economic Forum on Africa. Now the WEF is focused on another goal, making sure that Africa's economic growth impacts hundreds of millions of Africans who struggle to survive in chronic, grinding poverty. Business and government officials from the world's largest economy, the United States, say this year's conference, held this week in Cape Town, has seen a growing awareness of the need for stable and sustainable growth that helps ordinary people as well as investors. Elizabeth Littlefield is president and CEO of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, a U.S. government organization that provides financing for private sector projects. It focuses on initiatives that will lead to greater growth and development, like renewable energy, solar and wind power facilities, and natural gas projects.
We're seeing more and more interest. And one challenge, one of the many challenges, but I would say one that we see on the horizon that I'm quite interested in, is how do we make sure that economic growth, which is so powerful in so much of the continent, benefits all of Africans, lifts up livelihoods, and improves lives of ordinary Africans as well.
But, says U.S. Trade and Development Agency Director Leocadia Zak, major challenges remain. One is the continent's dire lack of good roads, electrical grids, and other structures needed for strong economic growth. The World Bank estimates that Africa needs investments of at least $93 billion a year to fix these problems.
One of the things that we have heard consistently throughout the past couple of days is that one of the biggest constraints to economic growth on the continent is the lack of infrastructure and the need for infrastructure. And what we've also heard is that one of the constraints to the development of that infrastructure are well-prepared projects.
Infrastructure development can be a tough sell for the profit-hungry investor crowd, as it takes time and massive resources. But Daniela Baluarez, the State Department's Senior Advisor for Development, says she is pleased to hear investors say they are more interested than ever in development projects.
At World Economic Forum in Africa, we've seen that the business community wants to be a part of this as well.
hearing both businesses and governments speaking about the importance of inclusive growth, the role that private investment can play in addressing energy challenges, agriculture challenges, the opportunity to increase the role of women in the economy and the benefits for growth that has.
The conference ends Friday. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
It's been called Nollywood Siorsien, a Nigerian film festival, which is wrapping up its third edition in Paris Sunday. Nigeria is now the world's second largest movie producer, but film quality has not always been tops. That is changing, however, as Lisa Brown reports for VOA from the French capital.
I give your golden girl 2 months. Another relapse, and she's out.
Move over, Hollywood. After India's famous Bollywood, Nigeria's Nollywood is now the world's second largest filmmaker, producing about 2,000 or more movies every year. Some of the best are being showcased at Nollywood Week, a film festival that's wrapping up its third edition in Paris. Nigeria may be an Anglophone country, but festival organizer Serge Nkoué says it makes sense to hold the festival in the French capital.
Paris is the world's cinema capital, in a way. It's really an important city for cinema. It's a city that matters. And I believe Nollywood is an industry that matters. I believe that it just made sense to have a platform here for Nollywood, and especially Nollywood's finest films.
Ladies, I found a guy, and he may just be the one.
Maybe!
The festival has been airing a mix of movies, including drama, comedy, and even a zombie thriller. Also in the lineup were episodes of the popular Nigerian TV series Before 30, about the pressures faced by Nigerian women to get married by that age. The festival opened with Jimmy Goes to Nollywood, a documentary about Haitian actor Jimmy Jean-Louis discovering the film industry. Rachid Dibou co-directed the movie.
Au départ, les gens rigolent parce que le film il est pas forcément très propre, il est pas académique.
He says at the beginning, people laughed at Nigerian movies because they were cobbled together on a low budget. But today, their quality is much better, and they're really giving Nigeria an international stature. Cameroonian Ernest Bong, who works in the music industry in Paris, has attended all three editions of Nollywood Week.
Because it brings a lot of light on the work people are doing down there. Full of many things, many stories, taken from our roots and also from what people are living daily. That's really important, interesting for all of us. And it's really entertainment.
We are now at war with sickle cell as our bodies under the strain of the pregnancy. The odds are against us, but we can win.
Nkoué is not sure what next year's festival will offer. He's hoping to eventually include films from other African countries. But either way, he says, they will reflect a Nollywood state of mind, which is about being independent and making movies that ordinary people care about. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
There is revival underway of specialty coffee exports from the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC. International experts recently held a specialty coffee tasting competition in the eastern DRC city of Bukavu and graded the 30 entrants. According to one of the organizers, the Eastern Congo Initiative, a nonprofit funded by Hollywood actor Ben Affleck, this was the first specialty coffee competition that's ever been held in DRC. For VOA, Nick Long has details from Bukavu.
In the mid-1980s, the Democratic Republic of Congo was officially exporting up to 130,000 tons of coffee per year. But by 2012, that figure had shriveled to 8,000 tons, owing to war, coffee disease, low prices and smuggling. However, international buyers of specialty, high-quality coffee have started to realise they have been missing out. In 2012, the World Coffee Research Institute, after doing a survey of the two Kivu provinces in eastern Congo, described the area as a paradise for coffee. That same year saw a Congolese coffee cooperative break through into the world's specialty market, helped by the UK-based fair trade organisation Twin. Richard Hyde, one of Twin's coffee experts, suggests that many other cooperatives in the Kivu provinces could do the same.
We know that potentially all the coffee from South Kivu to North Kivu is great coffee. It's just a question of knowledge, of equipment, of follow-through.
The coffee tasting competition held on Wednesday was the real test of that proposition for the more than 30 cooperatives that took part. Another of the organisers, Chris Traitor of the US coffee buyer Higher Grounds Trading, explained the importance of the event.
This is a very historic day to have people from all across the value chain of specialty coffee in one place and trained judges testing and sampling the different coffees in the region that are traceable in order to evaluate them all on one table for the first time.
The competition used global standards drawn up by the Specialty Coffee Association of America. It was a blind tasting, meaning judges had no idea whose coffee they were sampling. It was a fairly silent process too, except when the judges noisily spat out each sample.
And keep the noise down, please.
The judges waxed lyrical about the entries to this competition. Here is Stephen E. Vick, a buyer and taster for Blue Bottle Coffee, talking about a sample that he graded 91 out of 100, an exceptionally high score.
I loved it from the beginning. The fragrance was, I think, the best of any of them we've had. It's super complex, a lot of cherry, super silky body. I just wanted to drink the cups. They were just gorgeous.
Number one goes to CPCKS.
The winning cooperative, like several other entrants, had been helped by consultants working for Eastern Congo Initiative. The reason non-profits get involved in the sector is because much of Eastern DRC's coffee is produced by smallholder farmers working in very difficult conditions. One of the ways Eastern Congo Initiative tries to help those farmers is to lobby the DRC government on their behalf. The competition was an opportunity to do just that, as the Provincial Minister for Agriculture was attending. ECI's Baraka Kasali pointed out one way the DRC government could have helped producers of a coffee consignment recently sold to a new international buyer.
The biggest hurdle that I see is in the tax. Mm-hmm. We saw that during that first lot, 70% of the cost of that coffee went to taxes.
Congo's export tax on coffee is 12% compared with 1% in neighbouring countries. In reply to Kasali, the provincial agriculture minister, Adolphine Moulay, said perhaps the taxes are exorbitant. Nick Long for VOA News, Bukavu.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. On Saturdays, tune in at 3:30 and 14:30 UTC. And on Sundays at 5:30 and 17:30 UTC. Or subscribe to the Encounter podcast. Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. Send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. That's Encounter on VOA Africa.
Ghana begins a three-day national mourning beginning on Monday following a recent explosion at a petrol station that left at least 200 people dead. This after heavy flooding following hours of a heavy downpour in the capital Accra and its environs. David Akwa-Steven, journalist with Radio Gold in the Ghanaian capital Accra, joins us live via telephone link up. Hello, Roland. How are you, Roland?
I'm very well, yourself?
I'm well, thank you. Now, Roland, tell me, what is the program for tomorrow, Sunday? Monday, rather.
Well, what it is really is to acknowledge the extent of the damage and to, as it were, make some kind of recompense for the lost and departed souls. So the whole idea, as declared by the president, is to put the country in a to mourn significantly with the families that have lost their beloved ones, children, wives, husbands, relatives, and friends alike.
Now, why has this flooding problem persisted in Accra all this while?
Well, it is, our season, usually the rainy season is between, the peak of the rainy season is June, July, August. And globally, as everybody is talking about climate change, although for the past 3, 4, 5 years, we've never seen it that way. But the last time it did happen like that was in June 2009, when I remember your very good station, so others locally, did talk about the calamity, the chemical nature of the downpour. This particular one was really taking almost everybody aback, because it wasn't expected, because we thought that the city authorities had read the critical damages and all that. But we woke up on a Thursday morning and it was a disaster.
Now, Roland, some Ghanaians I spoke with said that lots of promises have been made, but yet there have been any measures put in place to resolve this recurring flooding. Are they calling for the head of some people to roll, or are some people ready, or some of these leaders ready to resign?
Resignation is not a culture when it comes to public office in this part of the world, and particularly our country. How would you see people resigning because of acts of omission or commission? Yes, it is true, some have called for the regulation of certain key appointments. But more importantly, and quite importantly, the issue is the people that gave, especially within the EPA or the Environmental Protection Agency, that gave time to certain people that are able to put buildings, structures on waterways. Now, the question is this.
Thank you very much, Roland. Sorry, we apologize for the poor quality of the line. Roland Akwa-Steven is a journalist with Radio Gold, a private radio station in Ghana. He joined us live from the capital, Accra.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sport with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, June 7th. Let's kick off with football news. All the four African representatives at the ongoing 2015 FIFA Under-20 World Cup in New Zealand have advanced to the round of 16. Nigeria joins Ghana, Mali, and Senegal in the next round, after defeating Hungary 2-0 in their final group match earlier today, Sunday. The victory meant that the Flying Eagles, as the Nigerian team is known, finished in second place in Group E, behind leader Brazil. Ghana finished as the winner of Group B, and like Nigeria, is a direct qualifier. However, Senegal and Mali, which both finished in third place in Group C and D respectively, went through as two of the best third place finishers. In the round of 16, African champion Nigeria will take on European champion Germany on Thursday. A day earlier, on Wednesday, two African teams, Ghana and Mali, will clash, meaning that at least one African team will not advance beyond the round of 16. On the same day, Senegal will take on the Ukraine. Ghana is the only African team to have ever won the two-yearly FIFA Under-20 World Cup. Meanwhile, the media officer for the Nigerian team, Sam Audu, has assured that the Nigerian team will qualify for the quarterfinals despite facing a tough opposition in the round of 16. Sam told me there is a lot of excitement in the team's camp ahead of the next match.
Everybody's excited. We are through to the round of 16, where we're going to play Germany on Thursday in Christchurch.
I'm looking at the results of Germany in the first round matches. Germany beat Fiji 8-1, beat Uzbekistan 3-0, and hammered Honduras 5-1. Does that bother Nigerian players and officials?
Well, Nigeria, as we all know, they like challenges, and this would not be any different. And also, when you mentioned the likes of Honduras and Fiji, by all standards, they're not world powers. So I would want to look at these results and downplay them. We are really looking forward to the challenge, and I believe it will be a clash of African champions against European champions. And I believe at the end of it all, the African champions will come through.
That was Sam Audu, the media officer for Nigeria's team to the ongoing FIFA Under-20 World Cup in New Zealand. He spoke with me on telephone from New Zealand. Staying with football, the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup kicked off in Canada on Saturday. Three teams, Nigeria, quarterfinalists at the tournament in 1999, as well as debutants Cameroon and Ivory Coast, are flying the African flag at the competition. Ivory Coast would be the first African team to test action when it goes against 2003 and 2007 champion Germany later today, Sunday. In the two matches played on the opening day, host Canada, which finished fourth in 2003, defeated 1999 runner-up China 1-0, while debutant Netherlands beat New Zealand by the same scoreline. In African football news, the qualifying series for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations in Gabon is due to kick off on Friday, June 12th. The qualifiers will run through September 4th, 2016. A total of 51 teams will feature in the qualifiers. The teams are divided into 13 groups of 4 teams each, with the exception of one group that has only 3 teams. At the end of the qualifiers, all the group winners, plus the two runners-up among 4 team groups with the best records, will qualify. The 15 teams will join host Gabon, which qualifies automatically in the 16-team final. Meanwhile, African champion Ivory Coast is in crisis ahead of the start of the African Nations Cup qualifiers. The Ivorians have yet to name a squad after top players failed to respond to call-ups. Ivorian Football Federation officials are trying to persuade key team members to travel to Gabon for next Sunday's Group I fixture, which marks the start of the defense of the title they won in February. Ivorian Federation officials admitted there was little enthusiasm among several leading players to play following a long-running controversy over the non-payment of promised bonuses from their Nations Cup win in Equatorial Guinea. Although part of the qualifying process, matches involving Gabon in Group I will not count towards the final standings. This is because Gabon, as host, is an automatic qualifier. In other news, a Nigerian high school student, Chinedu Okolo, has been invited to the South African team that is preparing for the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Chile later in the year. Okolo, who was born in South Africa, currently plays for the Under-17 team of SuperSport United Club. Chinedu's father, Lawrence Okolo, confirmed the invitation extended to his son.
I feel very pleased and honored. I thank God for the blessings, and I have no doubt in my mind that the boy will do well. He has been a good boy, well behaved, and he has been fighting hard to do his best.
Finally, athletics. Kenyan runners Ibrahim Cheruben and Rose Chelimo won the top honors at the Matoni Cheske Bidovice Half Marathon in the Czech Republic on Saturday. Cheruben, the fifth fastest of all time at the distance, won the men's race in 61 minutes and 24 seconds. In the women's race, Chelimo maintained her impressive form by winning her fourth half marathon of the year in 72 minutes and 1 second. After the race, the energetic Andy Edwards spoke with women's title winner, Rose Chelimo.
You won outside 72 minutes. I think it showed that it was really warm conditions. Did it feel like that?
Yeah, it was very hot, and the weather was too hot, and the race was tough. And I managed to make it to be the winner of the day.
What's next for you? Because you've won four. Are you going to have a rest and then set other targets? And if so, what are your other targets for the rest of the year?
No, so for now I'm going to have a rest, and then from there maybe I can prepare for 10K.
Do you have marathon ambitions? I mean, you're looking at what you do on the shorter distances. What could you do? I mean, 68 to 20-something, 22, in fact, you personal best to win Lisbon end of March. That's good running.
Yeah, for now, marathon, I've not prepared yet. Maybe in 1 year time, I'll run marathon.
Many thanks for that interview, Andy. And on that note, we'll wrap up this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Well, it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
There's no hesitating. I got my mind pressing. Every day me paper chasing. The people tell me I'm jonesing. Right now me and my people we are balling. We are go to the club every day and nights we popping. Everybody clubbing. The people them are jumping. Oh na na. Yeah yeah. Now because I'm making money, the people say I join Illuminati. Yeah, but I really don't know. I'm making money, the people say I join Illuminati, yeah. Well, I don't know what to say. Everybody get down. Everybody get down on it. Everybody get down. Get down on it. All my people get down. Get down on it. Everybody get down. Yeah. Get down, yeah. This is it. All I want is success. Yeah, yeah. I'm not here to impress anyone, yeah, yeah. So if you the vex, vex, brother, please no vex. I'm not here to oppress, yeah, yeah. Sometimes I ask myself, I wonder how I got this far. I'm listening, boy, nobody used to care after us. Sometimes I ask myself, I wonder how I got this far. I'm the same person, nobody care about, yeah.
Right now I'm making money. Them say me I join Illuminati, yeah. I don't know. Hey. Right now I'm making money. Them say me I join Illuminati, yeah. I really don't know. All my people get down. Get down on it. Everybody get down. Hey, get down on it. All my people get down. Get down on it. Everybody.
Shake up your bam bam, bam bam, bam bam. The way she a wine, girl, you really a mess up my mind. The way you roll your behind, if you make a man to go blind. Girl, me love you to pito. The way she my music is sweet to. The way she dance it to. Everybody them a love it to. Yeah. She got your bam bam. Everybody rap a bam bam. Yeah. She got your bam bam, bam bam, bam bam. Shake up your bam bam, your bam bam, your bam bam. See, oh no no no, yeah 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 yeah. My body nah yeah yeah, but my mind not there yet. Me I like it in lala, it in lala. Anyhow, I give it to you. So I know what you want to. I'm still on the bam bam.
All you got to shake up your bam bam.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. President Muhammad Buhari, who was recently inaugurated, is being severely tested by the militants Boko Haram. It has long been the practice that militants, terrorists, or whatever you like to call them, are in the habit of testing a new leader or government in order to determine how best they can cope with them. In his campaign to become the president of Nigeria and during his inauguration, President Buhari made it clear that one of his objectives was to combat Boko Haram and end the insurgency. In order to underline this resolve, he announced that the headquarters for the fighting against Boko Haram would be transferred from Abuja to Maiduguri in the northeast, which is seen as the home of the insurgency. President Buhari has also made it clear that he would cooperate fully with all the neighboring countries that have been participating in the war against Boko Haram, that is Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. And his first trip abroad had been to Chad for consultation with these countries. He has also made it clear that he will spare no efforts for resources to be given to the army to meet this challenge. Nigerian experts have, however, warned that it would not be possible to defeat Boko Haram only by military means. They said that besides military forces, other factors such as psychological, economic, and sociological challenges should be included. They pointed out that Nigeria should be able to ask itself, how is it possible for a young woman of 14, 15, 16 could become a suicide bomber? What kind of indoctrination had gone on? But we also should not forget that these young women may have not been conscious in what was being done to them. During the early stages of the Liberian Civil War, many young people were given drugs, and this enabled them to undertake attacks without knowing what they are doing. So the fight against Boko Haram will go on, despite the fact that since the inauguration of the president, Boko Haram has been staging attacks after attacks to prove that it's still a main force. In fact, it has declared that the army had not removed it from the areas of operation as had been declared, and said that it's still on the move. But it may also be possible that already Boko Haram is changing its tactics and going towards a type of guerrilla warfare. President Buhari is also faced with a challenge linked with the fight against Boko Haram. Just after he was inaugurated, Amnesty International published a damning report against the Nigerian army, in which it accused senior military officers of having committed atrocities against civilians up to 8,000. Although President Buhari is reluctant at this stage to criticize the army because he would need them to fight against Boko Haram, he had also pledged that he would leave no stone unturned and would look through the report of Amnesty International so as to take appropriate action. Another challenge linked to the war is to be found in the Delta region. The Delta region has been quiet for most of the presidency of President Goodluck Jonathan. There had been an agreement, but during the campaign, President Buhari hinted that he might halt the payments. Now, the insurgency in the Delta has said that it would resume its attacks against the oil pipelines and structure should he do that. So we have to see whether President Buhari will be ready to fight on two fronts, against the insurgency if resumed in the Delta and against Boko Haram in the Northeast. He also has questions dealing with the economy. As we witnessed just before he took power, there was the issue of payment of dues, which led to the withdrawal of petroleum supplies and long lines of customers. This issue, however, was solved just prior to his taking over the government. All of this shows that it would not be easy for President Buhari, and the test would be how long will the Nigerian people wait before they expect results. President Buhari himself had said after 100 days he could produce some results, but there are Nigerians who are waiting for an earlier result. So this is what we have to watch, because it would be devastating if after they have waited for so long, they lose faith in the new president. This also shows, and this must be known by the people of Nigeria and many Africans, that governance has certain profound constraints, and whatever you say in the campaign trail may not be easy to accomplish once you have become the president or leader.
Thank you as well. That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when the bush is on fire, the antelope ceases to fear the hunter's bullet. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Zimbabwe, once a pride of Africa and its breadbasket, has fallen far in recent decades, driven down by government policies, political violence, and economic decline. The nation's leaders, after many years of confrontation, now seek to re-engage with the West, hoping to see an easing of targeted sanctions they blame for many of the country's problems. Some restrictions, in fact, have been removed by the European Union against some officials, and the possibility of financial aid has been discussed. The United States, however, believes that current circumstances in the troubled Southern African nation do not merit a change in our policies there, though we remain hopeful that in the future they will. Last month, two top U.S. diplomats, Deputy Assistant Secretaries of State Shannon Smith and Stephen Feldstein, spent 4 days in Zimbabwe assessing conditions there with government leaders, U.S. Embassy staff, opposition lawmakers, and civil society. In the meetings, they reaffirmed U.S. messages of support for the Zimbabwean people and communicated our nation's hopes for economic development and democratic reforms. They also pressed the case of human rights activist Itai Dzamara, who went missing on March 9th after having been forced into a car by five men. He hasn't been seen since. What they found was a fractured political system, an economy in desperate straits, and looming food insecurity caused by drought and harmful government agricultural policies. Against this backdrop, they reported at the time, and Mr. Smith repeated in a hearing before our Congress on June 2nd, that U.S. interests in Zimbabwe remain the same. Travel and financial sanctions imposed on government leaders and their supporters linked to political violence and human rights abuses will remain in place, while we continue to support and promote a peaceful, democratic, and prosperous Zimbabwe that provides for its people and contributes to regional stability. To realize these interests, we will remain engaged with both government and non-government leaders alike to work together in areas of common concern. In so doing, the United States remains the leading provider of humanitarian assistance to Zimbabwe in the form of food aid, HIV/AIDS prevention programs, democracy, humanitarian assistance, economic growth, agriculture, and health infrastructure support. Our assistance has saved countless lives, is strengthening civil society, and is laying the groundwork for a brighter future for the Zimbabwean people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.